This Week in Retronauts, it's not the years, it's the miles. Everyone, and welcome to a Retronauts micro episode that once again focuses on a media property and also some of the related video games. My name is Jeremy Parrish, and I am like a shadow reflection of yourself. And with me this week, we have...
Binge Edwards.
That's it? Nothing pithy?
Dark Binge Edwards. Mirror Universe.
Okay, that's not even relevant to this week's topic. Chris... Oh, sorry, I spoiled it.
I'm Chris Sims, and they're digging in the wrong place.
Oh, you went with a different intro.
Didn't want to use my one cuss I've been allotted okay. Right here at the top.
Okay, don't want to work Bluey just yet. Yes, so this week we are talking about Raiders of the Lost Ark, not Indiana Jones franchise in general, but specifically Raiders of the Lost Ark, the movie, and the games based directly on the movies. So this will be like the Star Wars episode we did, which hopefully will have gone up by the time this goes live. If not, then you can look forward to it. But yeah, we're going to talk about the movie because it's a kind of, what do you call it? A pop culture juggernaut. Highly influential and also very relevant to Retronauts because of the way it sort of brings in lots of influences and reprocesses them into sort of a postmodern work. Would you consider Indiana Jones postmodern?
No.
I don't think I'd consider it postmodern. I would definitely consider it to be a modern sensibilities update on some classic ideas, but I think it's a little too straightforward and honest about itself to be postmodern.
You think postmodern requires someone to be not honest?
Not dishonest, but I think there's a level of irony that you get with postmodernism. Hmm. That
yeah, I'd say yeah, it's earnest portrayal of a sort of campy topic that's from cult. You know, what do they call that? The pulp fiction
serials.
Yeah. From the it's a take on that, right?
Interesting.
Okay. Yeah.
I would argue that there is an element of postmodernism to Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Because I don't even know what that is.
Postmodernism honestly, is, it's a literary movement that takes...
you think I read?
What are you doing? What are these notes doing in front of you?
I just look at the squiggly lines of characters. It's
fun. Yeah, postmodernism, it takes literary concepts or works that have come before and deconstructs them and then kind of works to serve as a commentary on them.
That's the thing. I don't think of Raiders as a deconstruction as much as a reconstruction. Like, it's taken elements from Flash Gordon, from Uncle Scrooge comics famously, and then put them together as more of a tribute, but also as a new version of the thing itself, if that makes sense.
Okay, that's fair.
I am not familiar enough with the original material to comment on that.
If there's one big flaw with Raiders, I think it's that it doesn't examine its tropes.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, I think you can certainly make the argument that Raiders of the Lost Ark could have stood to be a little more critical about some of the things that it incorporates. You were talking earlier about, Chris, about some sort of interview with Lucas and Steven Spielberg in which they... broke down the plot or something. You said they had some issues with Marion.
There's a transcript of them discussing the movie, like breaking the story in conversation with each other, which is pretty amazing, especially given how great that movie turns out. They do get to the part about Marion, and that's where all the stuff about Indy, their previous romantic entanglement being when Indy was like 25 and she was 15.
Oh.
Which is not great.
No.
And reading that transcript, they're totally fine with it. Like, yeah, that's a good plot point. Which it's not.
No.
It's not how I choose to read that
interesting
movie.
Yeah, because, that is a story point here. The main character, Indiana Jones, and the lead female character, Marion Ravenwood, clearly have a history behind them, and we'll talk about that. But when it's introduced, you find out that it happened 10 years before. So I was like, how old were they? So I looked at the age of the actor and actresses, and Harrison Ford was like 38 at the time of this movie, and Karen Allen was 31. So I was like, okay, so he's like 28, 29. She's like 20, 21. That's not ideal, but I can, you know, I can see that, you know, like a college grad, a student assistant, maybe getting a little too familiar with a college student. That's not good, but it could be worse. But 25, 15, that's worse.
Yeah. I think it's weirder when you see it all written down. It makes a lot of sense given the conversation that they have when he first shows up, when Indy is clearly a friend of her dad's. But the, you know, once we see Abner Ravenwood show up in Last Crusade, it makes a lot more sense. For
Wait, he does?
Yeah, he's the guy who gives Indy his hat.
Who takes the
cross of Coronado. Yeah.
He is?
That's Abner Ravenwood?
That's Abner Ravenwood.
Weird. Because like you had a rough luck or whatever, kid, but keep trying.
Yeah.
That's Abner Ravenwood?
That's Marion's dad.
No one explains that in the movie.
How do you know
this?
I really like Indiana Jones.
Wow. Okay.
But I mean, like, when you see, you know, River Phoenix as young and Indy, he's a teenager. He's like 16, 17. So it would make sense that like that is when he would have his relationship with an equally around the same age Marion, which that's how I choose to read that relationship. But yeah, like there's not a lot of examination of some of the,
there's definitely an age imbalance between the two characters. I did not mean to for this podcast to turn into like the Indiana Jones pedophilia podcast.
Yeah, maybe we just ditch all this.
Yeah. No, but I mean, it does kind of get to, I think the setting of the film, you know, the fact that it's set in like 1930 or something, and you know, just the things that it's reprocessing and recreating. There were different social mores at the time.
Yeah, I think people
did get married when they were like 12, even as late as, you know, the 30s and 40s. Like it was a different world. And I'm not saying like, oh, that's great, it's fine. No, it was actually kind of bad, but that's how things were. So
the thing is that it doesn't fit with what makes Indy work as a character, which is that he's the kind of a self-effacing everyman, even though he's like a hyper competent.
But that wasn't really Lucas's original vision for him. He was supposed to be like this randy playboy, you know, like goes to the high life, spends a lot of money, is very promiscuous with women. There's even a scene that they filmed for the movie. I was reading this book by J.W. Renslor, the Making of Indiana Jones or something. It's like in-depth breakdowns of the creation of all the movies. And I read specifically like start to finish how this movie was made. And there's even a scene where I think the girl who has the love you written on her eyelids in his class, like when Denholm Elliott's character, Marcus Brody, comes to Indy's house to say, let's go find the Ark. Originally it was filmed with that student, like hanging out with Indy after hours in his living room, having a drink. So there was like this kind of idea that I think George Lucas originally had for Indiana Jones that doesn't come through in the movie. And it's really good that it doesn't, because you know, the Indiana Jones we get on screen is extremely likable and a very empathetic character, but it would be so easy to take that in the wrong direction and make him really despicable. And I think
smarmy.
Yeah, I think this is kind of an example, like we sort of talked about on the Star Wars episode, about how George Lucas has really good ideas, but he really needs other people to come in and say, no, George, let's steer this in a different direction and make it a little better. Let's sand off the rough edges.
Yeah, and this was what, 81?
Yes.
So, I mean, this Harrison Ford at this time would have had plenty of experience working with Lucas and and adjusting lines. And, you know, I mean, famously, he ad-libs but like it was his idea to have Indy shoot the swordsman.
Actually, no.
No? Is that not true?
In the book that I was reading, that was not his idea.
I always thought it was.
I don't know how that's become attributed to him.
Legend.
But they actually filmed it both ways. This is another thing they filmed multiple ways. They filmed it both ways with like, you know, the large, I guess they call him Arab in the script. I guess that's what he is. Like the guy, you know, in the black outfit with the red sash and the giant scimitar. He like comes into the marketplace. He's like, there's going to be a big fight. They actually like filmed the whole fight. And then, you know, they also filmed a very short abbreviated take where instead of having a big fight, Indy just pulls out his pistol. He's like, I'm sick of this, and shoots the guy. And that's it. And that they actually came up with the alternate take on that because Steven Spielberg was really, really just like everyone was getting heat stroke and they were getting dysentery and they were just miserable working in Tunisia in, you know, like 105 degree, 110 degree weather every single day for weeks on end. And he was like, we just have to get out of here. And so they decided to, you know, really cut that scene and make it just like quick and efficient. And later, they had that edited into the movie and Lucas was like, you know, this is not how I envisioned the scene. Where's, you know, where's the full fight? And Spielberg was like, it's better this way. And Lucas said, no. So they edited in the full fight. And Spielberg was like, I don't think this is better. And Lucas said, well, I think it is. So they took it to test audiences and test audiences loved when Indy just pulls out the gun and shoots the guy instead of having a big drawn out fight, because coming, you know, in the middle of all these different fights, after all these different elaborate scenes that have been so beautifully choreographed and, you know, just like everything is amazing and really tense and very artful, to have him just like cut through that like Gordian knot and just shoot the guy instead of going into a whole lot of detail about it. It's really funny. It's a great scene. That's not Harrison Ford, though.
I had always heard that was Harrison Ford. Yeah, so nobody email me if I'm also wrong about Abner Ravenwood, by the way.
I mean,
now I'm thinking that might be likely, but it's a very revealing moment for Indy as a character too. Like that's what makes it work. Like Indy's competent. Pragmatic. He's good, pragmatic, but he's also pragmatic and he's not great. Like, he can't beat that guy in a sword fight.
No. So he's just like, whatever. He pulls out his pistol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's it.
That's the only, like, if you want to talk about it being postmodern, I think that's
the moment.
In the same vein as John McClane, like the original version of John McClane that we see in Die Hard, he's good, but not great.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to a James Bond, like, right. You know, Roger Moore could have defeated that guy
right.
with his hand tied behind
Well,
his
George
back.
Lucas envisioned, okay, we haven't really talked about, like, we just kind of jumped straight into this conversation. Of the Lost Ark is a movie, came out in 1981. It had been in development for like 6 or 7 years by that point. Collaboration between George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. It was George Lucas's idea. Like the entire vision for Indiana Jones came from George Lucas, based out of his love of things that you mentioned, Chris, you know, Republic serials and, you know, Uncle Scrooge comics and just, you know, all these, you know, Treasure of the Sierra Madre and things like that. It was basically like all the stuff he watched as a kid that he loved and no one was making anymore. And so he was like, I'm going to turn this into a movie. But this was coming directly off of Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back. And he was like, I also don't want to be a director anymore. So he reached out to Steven Spielberg and said, I would love for you to direct this. So all of a sudden you have like the two most successful filmmakers in the world, George Lucas, fresh off of Star Wars, Steven Spielberg, fresh off of Jaws. 1941 hadn't quite come out yet. they're teaming up. So, wow, that's like really exciting. And it took a while for them to get the terms they wanted for this. They wanted like total ownership of the characters and the script and the rights and everything, which studios were like, that's not really how we do things. But on the other hand, you have George Lucas and Steven Spielberg coming to you saying, we would like to distribute our movie through your studio. I think, you know, at some point, someone at Paramount, oh, it was actually Michael Eisner, or Jeffrey Eisner, one of the Eisners, you know, the guy who went on to take over Disney.
Michael Eisner.
Okay. Yeah, he finally was, you know, pragmatic and said, this is going to make us a lot of money. So, you know, that's okay. So they came up with terms and they made the movie. And, My favorite anecdote that I discovered in researching this episode is that someone asked George Lucas, why didn't you direct it? And he said, because if I had directed this movie, I never could have watched it. And I think that's it really speaks to where this movie came from. And it came from a genuine love by George Lucas for a genre. And, you know, the movie changed a lot in Spielberg's hands. And, you know, the producer was Frank Marshall, and the script was treated a couple of different times by different people. I forgot the lady's name, but she was the lady who did a lot of work on Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back and then passed away. She did the first draft of this. I feel stupid that I totally blanked out on her name.
Yeah, I forgot her name too.
But
I know who you're talking about.
Yeah. I feel bad. I'm not trying to erase her from history. She was awesome.
I could look it up.
Yeah. Anyway, so it's like this amazing collaboration. You have Doug Trimble and Bill Sienkiewicz did like...
Sienkiewicz
did the concept art for this. It's just
Jim
like,
Steranko did some.
Oh, Jim Steranko. That's yeah. it. Not Steranko. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Steranko did that famous shot of Indy with a cigarette in his mouth
yeah.
and his shirt open. He's all like he's looking, on the cover of a Men's Adventure magazine.
Yeah, he's
magazine.
Like super... I mean... Yeah, his vision of Indy was more like John Hamm after a lot of extensive, you know, muscle building. And that's not what Indiana Jones ended up being, but that a lot of that has to do with the fact that they cast Harrison Ford, which was a last minute decision because George Lucas was like, well, I've worked with him on Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back, and I don't want to have like a Scorsese De Niro relationship. I don't want him to be like the only guy who's in my movies. But, you know, they cast all like they did casting calls and tried to find different people. And they were almost went with Tom Selleck.
Yeah, that's what I remember hearing.
They really liked him, and he was going to get the job. But when CBS, I think, found out that Paramount and Lucas and Spielberg were interested in him, they were like, well, we've got this contract with him for a TV show, a cop show, Magnum PI, that's just been inactive. If, you know, if he's this hot a property, we should launch this show. So he became locked down with that contract, and they had to find someone else. And at the last minute, like seriously, like a week before they started, you know, putting everything together, they were like, okay, Harrison, how about this? And he brought a lot of himself and his own sensibilities into the character. And I really feel like that's one of the things that makes Indiana Jones as a character work, especially in this movie, because this is Harrison Ford at the height of his powers. This is before he was Harrison Ford, like the ultimate superstar of screen. This is kind of what put him in that position. So there was still like a little bit of humility to him, I think, and he was still willing to act as opposed to what he did after this, which I feel was basically to tell everyone why he was too good to act in their movies and just kind of be himself. He's one of those guys who kind of, you know, just fell into the same shtick. But, you know, for like early Han Solo and Deckard and Indiana Jones, I feel like he brought something different to every role and he wasn't just being himself. But he really does soften Indiana Jones by making him not just like James Bond, where he's always cocksure and self-assured. And while there is that element to him, he's also very fallible and he screws up and he gets shot and he gets beaten up. And, you know, at the end, before you go into the big kind of climactic finale, that quote that I threw in at the beginning of the episode, it's not the years, it's the miles. That's something Harrison Ford did improvise in this movie. And it really kind of gets to the character. Like, he's, you know, fought all these Nazis and he's recovered the Ark and he won, but man, it sure took its toll on him. And you don't see that in James Bond. You didn't see that in other characters. They're always just like indestructible heroes. But this was Indiana Jones, who did impossible things and came out, you know, won the day, but holy crap, it took a toll.
Yeah, I think it's in Raiders. It might be in Last Crusade, but I think it's in Raiders. The first thing we see of Professor Henry Jones is him forgetting how to spell a word.
Yes, that's in this one.
Yeah, which is brilliant.
Because mm-hmm.
again, he's good, not great.
Right.
And well, I love that about him. It's very humanizing.
Everything about this does a great job of kind of giving you context and setup. Like, first of all, I love the fact that this movie opens with the Paramount logo, you know, the mountain. And then that fades into an actual mountain, in which is actually in Hawaii, but it's supposed to be in like the South American jungles. And you don't hear Indiana Jones speak for like the first 3 or 4 minutes of the movie. You don't see his face. It's like there's this caravan of people exploring in the wilderness, and you don't know what's going on. And then you finally kind of get to see him, and you're like, oh, he's really tough. But then as that scene goes on and he goes into the temple and... like he's figuring out all the traps and predicting things, he still screws up. Like he thinks he's got it. He thinks he's got this golden idol. He puts the sandbag on there. He's like, yeah, I'm going to trick this ancient uh-huh. trap, but he doesn't. And then it's just like all downhill from there. Like literally as the boulder is rolling downhill. And then he's running down to the water, trying to escape the natives, who are very angry that he has desecrated their temple, which is also not a good thing about this. There's, you know, like, I'm sure the cast and the writers of Black Panther would have some things to say about this movie if you asked them.
Yeah, could you make this movie today is the question, with all your liberal sensibilities.
I think you could.
You absolutely could.
I think, I have said it on this show before. I think Raiders is a perfect movie. There was a thing going around about a couple weeks ago on Twitter of people like saying like, hey, what's a perfect movie? Not necessarily the best one, but like everything works.
Ghostbusters.
Absolutely. Yeah. But for me, like Raiders as an adventure movie is as close to being perfect as it can be. Everything builds in the right way. All the small character moments. But I think it in recreating Doc Savage, which is essentially what it's doing, because it, as much as, you know, Star Wars is Flash Gordon through George Lucas, Indiana Jones is Doc Savage through George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. In recreating that, it recreates a lot of the problems with jungle adventure narratives and colonialist stuff. Right. Uh-huh. We have Sala, I guess.
Well, you know, the thing is, like, it could be okay, I suppose, that, you know, he was delving into an ancient jungle temple to find, a relic to put in a museum to put on display. But then, you know, the Jovitos show up and you're like, oh, they're protecting this. So clearly this is not like, you know, part of some ancient forgotten civilization. Like, they're right there. He's stealing their idol from them.
It's weird because we see Belloc show up and take it. But we know from the rest of the movie that Belloc is going to sell it. Like he's not going to put it in a museum. He's not going to preserve this piece of history. Belloc might have melted that thing down. We don't know, but we don't get that in that scene. We just see Belloc say, here's your idol. And then Indy has to run away. And it's like understood that this extremely handsome white dude is in the right in this moment in pillaging this poor South American culture.
Which extremely handsome white dude are you talking about? They're both handsome.
I would say Harrison Ford. Oh, like okay. If
Harrison the rugged Ford handsome, as Belloc, opposed to the British handsome.
Yes.
Okay.
The kind of American handsome right. that we like.
Right. Not that
carpenter handsome.
Not that fancy handsome.
But yeah, like I think you could. I think movies have proven that you could do that movie today. But should you? I think we're in a. Not that it was necessarily excusable in 1981, but I think we're certainly pop culturally past the point where not examining that stuff does not add anything new to an idea.
We talked about the big idea behind Raiders of the Lost Ark, which is the Lost Ark itself, which is that this takes place, you know, in the build up to World War II.
36?
Yeah, it's the mid 30s. So clearly, you know, Hitler and the Nazis are out there doing stuff, but America was not actually at war with them. So this was really playing off of the real world obsession that Adolf Hitler had with ancient religious artifacts and relics and, you know, just the idea of mysticism. And he was obsessed with things like the Spear of Destiny. And I don't know that Hitler actually looked for the Ark of the Covenant, which is the lost ark in question. But it's, you know, believable that he might have if he thought, you know, he had a lead on it. Like, hey, here was this incredible relic that was extremely important to, Jewish civilization and was lost and represented, you know, a pact with God. That seems like a good thing to find. That could be very powerful. But this is another area where I feel like it becomes a little bit postmodern because you have a Jewish actor or Jewish director, sorry.
Well, Harrison Ford's mother was Jewish. So he's kind of Jewish too. Depending on how you consider it. You
know? Sure. Yeah. But I mean, Spielberg is
truly,
know,
like,
his Jewish heritage definitely informs a lot of his work, and I feel like it informs it a lot here. You have, like I said, a Jewish director directing a movie in which the Nazis are trying to steal something very culturally and historically important to you know, the Jewish religion and the Jewish faith. And so Indiana Jones has to stop him. That's kind of interesting.
I think it's awesome. It's a perfect setting that mixes world history and events and all the, you know, the mystery of World War II. It must have been amazing for the generation of Spielberg and Lucas looking back at their, probably their fathers or, you know, whoever in their family fighting in World War II and that kind of thing. It's just so great. And the Nazis always make such a perfect villain because you can't.
Yeah, I've really noticed that wrong. Reading the news lately.
You know, like they can't, you know, I'm talking about traditional Nazis, you know.
Let's think back on our Nazi tradition.
Yeah, I'm not, you know.
No, I know what you're saying. I know.
I'm talking about German 1940s, 30s, 40s Nazi National Socialist Party. Perfect enemies.
Well,
but I have to clarify that it's just ridiculous. Sorry.
I mean, this was a movie made back when it wasn't controversial to punch a Nazi,
yeah.
Which apparently now it is. But yeah, this is actually the use of Nazis in this movie kind of makes me like question, not question, but it makes me wonder like what part the Raiders of the Lost Ark series, you know, the movies that came after it, have played in sort of commoditizing violence, like senseless violence in movies. You certainly had a lot of violence in movies before this, but this is one of the first movies I can really think of that I, you know, looking back in history where you just see like the good guy killing all kinds of dudes and beating them up and, you know, causing them to stumble into the propellers of flying wings.
It struck me when I saw it again recently, actually, I was struck by how violent it was. I didn't remember that. Maybe I watched TV edits when I was a kid or something, you know?
Probably.
Because I was like, man, people TV are dying did not left
show,
and right.
TV did not show the Nazi mechanic in the propellers.
That blood splatter on the swastika, though, is like one of the dopest cuts.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
in
it's
cinematic history.
It's great. I mean, that's Spielberg right there. This movie is beautifully shot and beautifully edited. And you have, like, one of the things that I think makes it work so well is you have scenes like, you know, Indy and the digging crew trying to unearth Tanis at sunset in the desert. And so like their silhouettes against the sunset in the desert. It's just, it's such a beautiful movie. It's so smartly shot. But again, like it really does sort of trivialize extreme violence against other people. And I feel like, you know, the use of Nazis, like they were the bad guys, made it easy to do that because, you know, before this you had Star Wars where you had stormtroopers being shot up, but those guys could have been robots. They were just wearing armor all the time. You didn't see their faces, but the Nazis, you see their faces. You even have like mid bosses. You have like certain enemies who appear throughout the movie that really pose a huge threat. There's like the cannon fodder, and then there's like the bosses. You have the Nazi mechanic, you have almost the large Arab with the sword who gets shot, you know, in one shot, but he would have been a mid-boss. You have the white-haired balding Nazi who drives the truck, or, you know, was behind the truck and then fights Indy in the truck. That's actually Harrison Ford's stunt double, by the way, which I thought was really interesting. So that gets kind of into some weird subtext
Shadow Link.
But yeah. But like these enemies, you know, they never become characters, but they are figures on the screen, and they do have some screen time. So you get like a lot of killing, some of it kind of brutal in a sort of edge of PG sort of way. I don't know. It's just, and then, you know, you have like the super gross out stuff at the very end when the wrath of God is like, yo, Nazis, what's up?
Yeah. I think what sets, you know, the mid-boss bad guys in this movie apart is that they do have those little touches of personality. Like the scene where he's boxing against the mechanic is great. Cause, you know, I mean, I say boxing because the guy could kill Indy, but he wants to fist fight him.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. He sees Indy making a mess of the mechanics on the airfield and is like,
yeah,
he comes out, he takes off his shirt. He's like, I'm a badass. I'm going to make this guy. Sorry.
This guy weirdly wants to have like a fair fight with Indiana Jones. And again, much like the swordsman.
He's like, hey, you. He's even speaking in English, like very accented English. Like, come on.
Are you okay?
Daidobu?
But I think, again, you get another scene like with the swordsman of Indy, or in this case, Marion, actually changing the rules of the fight. Indy cheats to win, which I like a lot. But get like, I've got a lot to say, Jared.
That's okay.
Getting back to just the idea of the arc. We know Belloc's a bad guy because he's working with Nazis. Belloc himself is this weird, completely amoral guy.
Yeah, he's like the classic, not bounty hunter, but mercenary is the term he uses.
Because
he says Indy's going to give a bad name to mercenaries.
Yeah.
But I feel like he already did.
But his whole interest in the arc, I mean, he calls it, you know, a direct line to God. And I kind of love the act of hubris of thinking specifically the God of the covenant is going to be okay with Nazis, which, you know, they should have thought that one through, or should not have. Yeah. They got what's coming to them.
You'd think.
Well, lots of people, dumb people have thought lots of dumb things.
That's true.
It's realistic.
I mean, this took place in what? 36, 37, supposedly. So when was Kristallnacht and things like that? Like
38.
Yeah. 38 was it? 38 was Kristallnacht.
So maybe, I don't know, maybe, probably shouldn't think too hard about it.
Yeah, we shouldn't get too deep into that sort of thing.
I think one of the things you get from, I don't know if this was the production design. I mean, you might know, Jeremy, you have the book downstairs, but one of the most viscerally upsetting, I guess, is a good way to put it, like things in that movie, is at the end when Belloc shows up in like the ceremonial robes and everything, but it's all covered in swastikas. Like, it's really weird and creepy and very, you know, like, you don't get Hellboy without that, you know?
Right, yeah. So they actually brought in a rabbi to consult on that part. Like, when Belloc is doing the incantation, that's actually, like, a fairly common prayer that he, like, an actual, you know, Jewish prayer. I don't know Jewish tradition myself, but, in the making of Indiana Jones, it talks about how they, like, brought in a rabbi just to make sure that everything was, like, I was going to say kosher, but
realistic.
not just authentic, but also like wouldn't cause tremendous offense.
Well, I think, you know, when you explain, hey, right after we see this, they're going to get melted by the power of God.
Well, I mean, it's clearly meant to be an evil perversion of religion.
And that's understandable. Like to me as a kid, even before, you know, I mean, God, I watched this movie. It's one of the first movies I can remember watching. Mm-hmm. Like, even before I knew anything about World War II, like, you can tell it's wrong, which is really cool.
Yeah, like, there's something bad happening here. And even if you don't know the history behind Nazis and Judaism, like, you still know this isn't right. Like, there's something bad happening here.
Yeah.
But, you know, actually knowing all that stuff, again, I feel like that must have been something that Spielberg brought to this, is just the idea of this perversion, this obscenity happening. Like this piece of important religious lore being unearthed and then being perverted like this, like that really just kind of, you know, it makes the violence so much easier to go down because they got their faces literally melted off like candles, but you know, that's what they get for messing with God this way.
Because I mean, it's established in the film, like historically, we know what they would have done with it. In the film itself, we know what they're going to do with it. It's going to, you know, they're going to use it to lead their armies to victory. And, you know, 40 years later, we know that's a bad idea. As to the commodification of the violence, one of the weirdest things about the Indiana Jones franchise, I think, is a couple of years ago, not a couple of years ago, maybe like 10 years ago, they made Indy action figures. Hasbro was making them.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, I loved them because they were 3 3/4 scale, which meant they were the size of G.I. Joes.
They were articulated like G.I. Joes in a lot of ways, too.
You could have Indy riding in the Awestriker with snake eyes, which I absolutely did.
I mean, I watched that movie, I'm sure of it, when I was a kid.
But they do this in the Lego games, too. But they did it on the action figures. They don't call the Nazis Nazis. They call them, like, enemy soldier. Presumably because Hasbro was like, hey, what if we don't put the word Nazi on these toys we're going to send to Walmart? But when you remove that and you remove like all those trappings, like I remember the back of the card bio for like the Nazi soldier, the enemy soldier, was something about like how, you know, he's serving his home, you know, he's far from his homeland, serving in the heat of the desert. And I was like, you're making that sound a little too noble and a little too relatable. That's good. That's a problem, guys. But you know, they do the same thing in the Lego games where they're enemy soldier, enemy whatever.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons Temple of Doom doesn't sit so well is because you don't have like clearly evil people. I mean, yeah, they're bad guys, but it's like, aren't we kind of intruding on their place? Like, isn't this their temple that we're intruding into? Like, you kind of get back into the whole jungle adventure thing. Whereas with Nazis, they're the ones who are invading. They're the ones who are trying to exploit other peoples. So yeah, it's totally fine to kill them by the droves. But when you're going in and like killing thuggy guards, I mean, they're not up to anything good, but still like,
Temple of Doom also really goes hard at the, look at this weird other culture stuff. Mm. Like, especially in the beginning, that's not great.
Well, this isn't the Temple of Doom podcast.
Thankfully. It's not, thankfully. Because there's so much about it. And I didn't mean for this to become like an hour long discussion about the weird subtext of Indiana Jones. We've barely talked about
it. Don't get me wrong.
This just wasn't quite what I've envisioned for the podcast.
Yeah, me neither.
But
you want to start over?
No.
Just talk about how good it is when he throws Nazi into the propeller.
I talked about how great Indiana Jones is himself. And I really feel like a big part of what makes Indiana Jones great is the people he's cast opposite, especially Karen Allen as Marion Ravenwood, who is every bit as tough as he is. She is not like, she's a damsel in distress sometimes, as the plot requires, but she also is more than capable of holding her own in most circumstances. And, you know, she becomes a damsel in distress when she's like held up by the entire Nazi army and cast down into a pit full of snakes. Yeah, okay, well, that's kind of a disadvantage. But, you know, like on her own, she holds her own. Like you are introduced to her in the midst of a drinking contest against this huge guy who cannot hold his liquor as well as she can. Like, she's badass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she gets up and does like a full scene in that and saves Indy when the big, you know, asking for a whiskey scene. Marion does function as a damsel in distress in that movie, but she's also a damsel who's going to stab Belloc in the neck with a steak knife,
right,
which helps a lot. I think she's a really great character.
Yeah. I think she's really modern in that sense, especially compared to like the lady in Temple of Doom, Kate Capshaw.
Yeah.
Ridley Scott.
Yeah. That's not let's not talk about Temple of Doom,
but I'm just saying as a comparison, this is a really wonderfully rounded three-dimensional female character in a movie, in my opinion.
No, she's great. She's she works and the movie needed someone like her because she is basically like the woman who could have been Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
I know that Spielberg is like, I'd be okay with having Indiana Joan. No, let's not do that. But yeah, like she is in her own way every bit as tough as he is. And she doesn't have the same experiences as he does, but she's, you know, survived in Nepal. She runs a bar. She like, you know, chases out these big scary dudes. She can drink them under the table. She's tough. And you know, she's very pragmatic and she's very resourceful. Like in the, you know, the marketplace scene, she's not a fighter, but when she is thrust into this conflict and all she has at hand is a frying pan that she grabs off a stall, she's still able to defend herself pretty well.
I'm really, I mean,
it's not her fault that she's betrayed by a monkey.
I know exactly why, but it's still really surprising to me that like Karen Allen didn't get like action movie parts after this. You know, like she's really good in this movie and like really compelling as that kind of character.
Yeah, I don't think Hollywood was ready for that kind of woman yet. Like with the, you know, raspy cigarette voice. And
that's what I'm saying.
Like she's very pretty and she's got the cute freckles, but then she's also like flinty. She's tough.
She's modern, a very modern character by our standards today. But yeah, ahead of her time at that time,
mm-hmm. I'd say. I mean, yeah, you know, what kind of female roles did we see in the 80s? Stuff like, you know, characters or actresses like Molly Ringwald and Phoebe Cates, you know, softer characters.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah.
The closest I can think of would have been like Linda Hamilton.
Right.
In Terminator.
But even she isn't really that tough in Terminator. Not she becomes Terminator tough 2. Later. Like Terminator 2, you're like, look at those shoulders. She could kill a man just by like flicking him with her finger.
Yeah, it's just with as successful as this movie was and as imitated as this movie was, like adventure movies of this kind were having a big resurgence in like the late 70s and early 80s. Like honestly, kind of starting with Conan, you know, that kind of big period piece and set piece after set piece movie. I'm really surprised there weren't more. There wasn't one about a Karen Allen type, as opposed to, you know, the barbarian movies about women that we got, which are not good, unfortunately.
What, Red Sonja? Not good.
Red Sonja is probably the best one of its type.
So many heads. It's really fun.
But yeah, I like Marion a lot.
Yeah.
So one of the we'll wrap up talking about the movie, but one of the reasons I think this movie has become so influential in other films and also in video games is because the movie is basically just a string of set pieces. It is action sequence after action sequence. You start out in the jungle and then you cut, get some context, end up in Nepal. All of a sudden you're in Cairo. They're in Cairo for like 3 minutes before they're attacked in the marketplace. And then that, you know, ends up with Marion presumed dead. So Indy goes to a bar and drinks for a little while. But
Indy getting depressed is a really good scene.
That happens so early in the movie. It's really startling. It's like you have barely known these characters and all of a sudden he's just like getting completely wasted and ready to kill himself or ready to, you know, die attacking Belloc. But then, you know, that's just like kind of the setup because then you have, let's see, what's after that? The yeah, there's a little bit of kind of slow down time where they figure out where the arc is.
Gotta take back one Kadan.
Right. But yeah, once they get all of that and they actually find the arc, then it's, you know, the snake pit, and then it's the airstrip, and then it's the chase from the airstrip, and then it's the boat and the Nazi subbase.
Cool,
and it's
boat over. Captain who we know nothing about.
Captain Katanga?
Except he's Indy's buddy.
I love that character. It feels like a true epic. I also thought that when I was watching it. It's so exciting and fun adventure.
But it takes place over the course of, aside from the intro, it's like over the course of 3 days, basically.
Yeah, but they go
super fast.
So many places on the map with the little line, right?
Yeah, it's quite a journey. Yeah. And like at every scene or in every location, there is at least one great action scene. And even, you know, even in the quieter moments, there's still stuff happening. Like, Indy, you know, sneaking into the sub base on the conning tower and then trying to find a uniform by
the uniform seems great.
Yeah. Just like beating up random guys and stealing their clothes.
The bit with the mirror where Marion uppercuts him with the mirror and it cuts to the wide shot of the ship and he's screaming and then do you see something?
No, it's like
so good.
There's a lot of comedy in this movie. So it's action. It's tense. Like you know, there had never been action scenes like this before. And there were all kinds of like practical stunts, such as Indy being dragged by a whip behind a truck along a dirt road, which they actually, you know, had like a guy out there doing that. They were, you know, they threaded the camera to go, you know, twice as fast when it was played back. But still, like, it's lots of practical effects. And yeah, it just like there's always something happening and always something of interest. And again, it's beautifully shot. It's not just action. It's beautifully rendered, extremely well staged action, great stunts, great effects. Some of the miniatures are a little, okay, whatever, but still, like, you know, the flying wing and things like that, there's, you know, real explosions happening in the background. It's crazy.
Again, not to keep harping on it, but like Temple of Doom is very soundstagey. Like, it's very sets. And Raiders never feels like that. It's set pieces. But it feels like they're at the places they're supposed to be at.
Yeah, I mean, they filmed in the desert, yeah. And that's one of the reasons I think they didn't do that with Temple of Doom, because everyone got really sick.
Yeah,
Did you know that the final canyon where he's threatening to blow the Ark up, that actually is filmed in the same canyon where the Jawas catch R2-D2?
Makes sense.
I saw a photo of it in that book, and it's like from a reverse angle, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, that's the Jawa Canyon. That's crazy. So there's like actual crossover between universes. If Indy had been there long, long ago, he would have met a Jawa.
You know about Chewbacca being the Sasquatch that Indiana Jones finds, right?
I did not know that.
There's a Dark Horse comic that was, I think it was Star Wars Tales, that did like in and out of continuity Star Wars stories. And in one of them, Han and Chewie go through a super warp or whatever and end up crashing the Falcon on Earth. And Indy comes looking for the Sasquatch 100 years later, and it's Chewbacca.
Wow.
Interesting. Well, there is the connection there that Indiana was the name of George Lucas's dog, and Indiana the dog is what inspired the look of Chewbacca. So there is some crossover. So we've talked a lot about the movie, and it was very disorganized, and I apologize for that, but I hope it was interesting. We are going to talk very briefly about the games based on Raiders of the Lost Ark, because there are a few of them, not just Indiana Jones movies, but specifically about Raiders of the Lost Ark. Actually, let's go backward. Let's start with Lego Indiana Jones, The Original Adventures.
I like that game.
Okay, you talk about it, because I cannot get into any of the Lego games.
Neither.
They're all the same, and they're all uninteresting to
me. They are all the same.
I don't like them.
The fun comes from like seeing how they're going to recreate different bits and pieces of the movie. No pun intended on that one, but like
and Lego pieces.
I think the indie one was one of the last ones that didn't have voice acting, so everything was like really big pantomime style for all the set pieces. And obviously they're for babies. So a Nazi gets chopped to his component Lego pieces,
right?
Instead of blood splattering on the swastika. But I think that those are fun. And I think one of the reasons that they're fun is that they assume that you are conversant in the movie enough to know what's happening. Because they were making games based on Star Wars and Indiana Jones, so they could get away with that. Mm-hmm. And seeing how they present those things in this weird, you know, sideways universe of toys for children was, I think, really interesting.
Fair enough.
Plus, they had the good sense to break out the first three Indiana Jones movies into their own game instead of lumping any additional Indiana Jones content that I do not acknowledge the existence of into there.
Are you talking about the Marvel comic series?
Yeah, the Marvel comic series and the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles.
Right. Yeah.
You know, there's an episode of Young Indiana Jones Chronicles that has Harrison Ford on it. As an adult. That's crazy.
And I think that Harrison Ford is almost as old as the guy who played old Indy is.
Old one-eyed Indy.
Yeah. So if they actually do go through with Indy 5, which supposedly they're going to do, I guess we'll see him lose his eye. Or maybe they'll just like, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I have mixed feelings about that. I wish they had made a lot more while he was young.
Yeah.
That would have been great. But
I think the Lego games are fun.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know what's not fun is Indiana Jones Greatest Adventures for Super NES.
Yep.
It's I played that for the first time today, getting ready for this podcast. And I was expecting something along the lines of Super Star Wars, like really hard, but visually stunning and, you know, sounded perfect and, you know, like a great bit of fan service. It's not. It's actually like it's got some major jank to it.
I think Star Wars, Super Star Wars, is hard but fair. It's just you take skill and to get through it. But that the Indiana Jones game, I was just playing it too a little while ago.
Were you now?
Yeah.
What a coincidence.
Yeah. It's weird.
I was also just playing it a while ago.
Was it all on the same TV set?
It might have been
PVM, whatever. Anyway, so this thing, whatever you call this game. Chronicles.
Indiana Jones Greatest Adventures.
Yeah, it just seemed unfair, the parts I played.
This game's trash.
And hard.
Yeah, it's weird because, you know, it is a Lucas-based game for Super NES, and coming on the heels of Super Star Wars and that trilogy, you kind of go into it expecting, like, this is going to be amazing. But all the reviews at the time said, wow, this game is hot garbage, so I avoided it. And now, you know, going back, I understand why they said that, because it's not made by the same people who made Super Star Wars. I don't know if Super Star Wars was internal Lucas or just like an uncredited studio, but this Indiana Jones was Factor 5. And I associate Factor 5 with good quality stuff. They made, you know, the Turrican games. They made the Rogue Squadron shooters and, you know, Rogue Leader or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like some really great, you know, cutting edge visuals, games on GameCube that still look amazing. This is not one of those. It's poor animation, poor controls. Everything is like really, really hard and not in a fun way. It's like Indy's whip takes two hits to kill a piranha, and you can't kill rats and spiders and enemies that are along the ground because they're too low, and for whatever reason, Indy can't actually
hit the ground. That's unfair. That's frustrating.
Traps just spring up out of nowhere.
Yeah. I don't like that kind of stuff.
There are areas of ground that will crumble under your feet before you can... Yeah, cross over them, but they're really hard to distinguish from the rest of the ground.
The gun sucks.
Yeah, like it's just everything's bad. So this game is from like 94, 95, Super NES. It should have been the amazing follow-up, the amazing indie follow-up to the Super Star Wars trilogy, but it's not.
That's exactly what I was expecting, because I heard about this game in Nintendo Power, I'm sure, which never met a game they didn't like. And I remember playing it when I was younger and being so hyped for it, because I thought the Super Star Wars games were really good and fun. And I loved Indy. So getting into this one was, I probably had the same experience playing it the first time as I did playing it today, where I took about a half hour to get through the first two levels and then just stopped. It's bad. You know what makes Raiders worse is if Indy's whipping the Jovitos to death on his way into the temple.
Yeah, he's not just stealing their idol; he's also killing them to get it.
That's a bad one, buddy.
It's not a good game, and I am very disappointed in it. One thing that I think is kind of interesting is that it breaks out all three movies. Maybe the reason it's kind of mediocre is because it is all three of the original Indiana Jones movies to that point. And you only can play Raiders when you first start up the game. You have to get a code to be able to play the other movies. Huh. And you have to beat Raiders in order to play the others. So that's kind of a steep challenge, a sort of high demand. But it does have a lot of content per game. Like there's like 12 stages per game or per movie. Huh. Each one... Well, most of them have their own look. Like Cairo is day and night, so it's pretty much the same thing with a palette cycle. But Nepal is like outdoors on a mountainside because, you know, of course, Indy spends a lot of time killing wolves and birds and stuff in the movies. And then you're fighting through the Raven, the bar that Marion owns, which is much larger than I remember it being in the movie. There are no Nazis, but there are a lot of rats and burning barrels coming at you.
Turn into a Castlevania Raven.
That's what
there is an element of Castlevania to it in that Indy starts out with just fists. And has to get a whip by like hitting chandeliers or candelabras or whatever.
You don't remember that scene where he finds the whip in the Jovitos temple?
Of course.
If I was going to say, if only the makers of this game had an extremely well-designed game about a main character who had a whip that was perhaps influenced by Indiana Jones.
Like you even do the Super Castlevania 4 whip swinging thing, but the controls are stiff and terrible. It's bad.
Should have just called up Konami. I mean, like, what you got?
I guess
what you got for whip guys?
Anyway, so I've only ever played the Raiders of the Lost Ark portion of the Adventures of Indiana Jones, Greatest Adventures, whatever. But it's just not fun.
I was going to say, what if the other two are really awesome?
You know, I bet they're not, but the other two do have vehicular sequences, which Raiders of the Lost Ark does not, which is really weird because there are some very memorable vehicular parts, like a whole scene about taking a truck from Nazis. Wow, that might have been made an interesting video game level, but no. The first vehicular level in the game is when Indy's plane crashes in the mountains and you're controlling the life raft, trying to dodge trees and jump over chasms in the mountains.
I think I need to get some Game Genie on this just so I can see it.
You can just get a password from...
really? Okay.
Yeah, from GameFAQs or something.
How do you look that up?
But man, it's probably not worth it. This is a big disappointment. I was actually kind of looking forward to playing this game when I sat down to play it today and practice for this podcast, but bad news. I mean, like I said, you know, Super Star Wars is pretty unfair, but I still enjoy playing it to a certain degree. This just does not have any spark to it. And then finally, the last of the games we're going to talk about, actually the first of the Raiders of the Lost Ark games, the first of any games based on Indiana Jones, is Howard Scott Warshaw's Raiders of the Lost Ark for Atari 2600, which, like the other Howard Scott Warshaw / Steven Spielberg collaboration, E.T., is a very ambitious game that punches way above its weight class and ends up being this sort of abstract, what the hell is going on experience.
A lot of Atari 2600 games are like that, though. Anything that's just a basic shooter or something.
Sword Quest and that series, and there's a lot of that here, too.
I grew up watching my brother play this game a lot, and in fact, it was one of his favorite Atari 2600 games, and his friend, they would sort of play it co-op in the sense that the second controller was used to control the inventory, like select which item you were using, and they would play it together, and then they'd get me to help choose it, and it felt cool that it was something you could play together, even though it's not designed per se as a two-player game or anything.
So let's walk that back. This is an Atari 2600 game with an inventory.
Yeah.
It has an economy. It has, like, you have to find gold bars and trade them to buy stuff. This is a really ambitious Atari 2600 game. It makes no sense unless someone sits down and explains it to you. Like, I tried playing it on an analog NT and was like, what am I doing? Yeah. So I sat down and watched a YouTube video that was annotated, and it kind of makes sense now, but I'm like, how would anyone have known this stuff? Like, you have to stand in a very, like, over a basket to make something appear for like 30 seconds or something. And then you have to, like, go to the Well of Souls and stand there until the sun comes up. And then you will see the exact pixel where you will find the arc if you go back to the cliffs. It's like, wow, this is a very cryptic game.
Well, I think that my brother's friend, who's named Chris, by the way, and Jeremy is my brother.
Interesting. Jeremy, okay.
Yeah, so...
just circling through history here.
He was a subscriber of Electronic Games Magazine at that time, and I think they must have had tips on how to play this game, because I don't know how they would have figured it out. But they did complete it. I mean, they would beat the game and sit down, and it felt like an epic adventure, and this is before we had Zelda and stuff like that. So
yeah, I think this is a game where if you knew all the steps to take and all the things you were expected to do, you could finish it pretty easily. It's just like figuring that out.
Yeah.
It's so, so abstract and so cryptic. And there's like weird things, you know, like an Arab sheikh who will steal your stuff if you touch him because he's insulted that you touched him or something. I don't remember that from the movie, but okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, like there's a lot of extrapolation here and like a really great idea, I think, inside of Howard Scott Warshaw's head, that just, you know, the limited capacity of the 2600 couldn't translate into a proper video game experience. Did he ever make video games after the 2600?
Not that I know of.
I feel like
he's kind of active on Twitter now. You could ask him.
Yeah, I feel like he's someone who would have been much more comfortable, like, during the NES or Sega Genesis era.
Because, like, psychologist.
Oh, okay.
Or something like that.
Because, you know, finally, you know, video game technology caught up to his ideas. But by that point, I guess he had moved on.
Yeah, I think he, I remember there was an interview with him in that Atari documentary about when they dug up the cartridges or something. I think they interviewed him, and he's talking about how Atari was the greatest thing that ever happened to him. And when it shut down, it was really a big bummer for him. And it sort of made him disenchanted. about the whole industry, and I think he just moved on to do something different. That's what I think, but you know,
I would certainly believe it.
Yeah. So, but this game in its context, I actually remember playing this in the, you know, in the early 80s, and we even played it in the mid 80s and early 90s when we'd get our 2600 out, and we had a really high respect for this game. I remember thinking that we thought this was one of the best games on the 2600. Mm-hmm. There's something about it at the time, even though by modern standards, it's really cryptic.
Well, it's
and
like
bizarre.
Super ambitious. I mean, yeah, I will certainly give it the like fact that it was really like, you know, an NES or PC late 80s style experience.
It's a true adventure on the 2600. You know, yeah, like that was a rare thing on that console, without a doubt.
So I don't know that there's ever really been a great game based on Raiders of the Lost Ark, although apparently this one was pretty good in its context.
In its context.
But there have been great Raiders or Indiana Jones based games. Did I say that right? Nothing based on Raiders of the Lost Ark that was amazing, but some great Indiana Jones movies or games. God.
Yeah. And there's one that's not based on a movie.
Not the first time.
Which is the best. The best one, Fate of Atlantis, was never a movie, and it's awesome.
Yep. And we will talk about that someday.
Okay. Cool.
We will definitely do a non-canon Indiana Jones video game podcast, because there are some really good ones. The Infernal Machine was also pretty good for N64.
Yeah, wasn't that on the Xbox as well? And
I don't believe so. Yeah. You're thinking of, there's a different one
that
came along a little bit later. The Infernal Machine was like 2000 and was very much in the Tomb Raider style, which is fine because Tomb Raider was very much in the Indiana Jones style.
Yeah.
So it all worked out.
It's funny how they all build, you know.
But yeah, the direct adaptations of the film, not so great, even if that one did mean well. So
the Last Crusade graphic adventure was pretty good.
Right, but that's not this film.
Yeah.
That's what we're saying.
Karen Allen would have been a really good reboot Lara Croft.
I agree.
In the early 80s.
Marion's Big Adventure.
Yeah, that would have been cool.
Like a post-2013 Lara Croft.
Hmm.
If we could get 1981 Karen Allen to 2013.
If they made
sure
movies,
there's technology to do that.
If they made movies back then like they do it today, they would have done that. Like 1,000 movies based on the same property kind of thing.
Yes. All right. So anyway, that's been an hour of talking about Raiders of the Lost Ark, and I feel like it was extremely all over the place, but... It wasn't staring
directly at me as you say that.
That's just because you're sitting across from me. I'm just gazing rapturously at you because you brought so much to this conversation. It was I who have failed to keep everything corralled. That's my fault.
Yeah, you guys had a lot to say about this film.
Surprised. You didn't. What's up?
Because I couldn't get a word in edgewise.
Next time you gotta like wave your hand.
I don't have any postmodern analysis of this film or whatever. I just like the rollicking action adventure it is.
Well, that's also relevant because it's a damn good rollicking action adventure.
Yeah,
but it's also, I think, pretty interesting to think about. There's some meaty substance to it. Some subtext.
Culturally analyze it by today's social standards, like you guys are doing, then yeah, you can get into all kinds of weird analysis of this film.
I don't think it's weird. I think it's, you know,
complex. Not
exactly
weird.
But I mean, I think that's important to be able to say, like, hey, so here's all these things we've taken for granted, but why don't we ask about them? Why don't we think about them?
Yeah. And that's also a question of, like, who are we as people who we consume this? I mean, Chris is 20% Indiana Jones. He just admitted it. He watched it 1,000 times.
He's 80% Batman.
What did these movies teach us about the morals of punching people and whatever, putting people into propellers? I mean, I've done that at least 3 times.
See, that's Europe. You've got
to
follow
up on
me.
Okay. Yeah. That's all right.
All right. Anyway, so this was a Retronauts. Are we calling this a micro? I guess so. Sure. Retronauts micro. A really long Retronauts micro. Retronauts macro.
Yeah.
I have been Jeremy Parrish, and I have been all over the map, just like Indiana Jones this episode. You can find me on the internet at GameSpite on Twitter and at Retronauts.com. Retronauts, of course, is available on your favorite podcast applications and at Podcast One. And we are supported through Patreon, patreon.com/retronauts. That keeps the lights on and the electricity for me to record these podcasts. So please consider subscribing. You'll get cool stuff if you do, I promise. Anyway, you guys, pimp yourselves.
I'm Benj Edwards. You can find more of my work at benjedwards.com or vintagecomputing.com, and I'm on Twitter at Benj Edwards.
I'm Chris Sims, and you can find out about me by going to the-isb.com. I do a bunch of stuff. I write comic books, I write columns online, and I do a bunch of podcasts. I just launched a new one. It's called Apocrypals. It's about me and my friend Benito reading the Bible. It's a good time, so you should listen to it.
If you're reading the Bible, that's not apocryphal, though.
We're also going... Somebody asked why we called it that. We're going to read the Apocrypha.
You should
be
the canon kids. No, okay.
No, we're gonna I think the plan is to do alternate between New Testament, Old Testament, and Apocrypha.
So. Oh, okay. I'd listen to the Apocrypha episodes. I don't really know that much about the Apocrypha.
Well, if you want to hear about Simon Magus coming back, episode 3 is gonna be a good one.
It sounds canonical. Cool.
Oh boy.
Anyway, this has been Retronaut. And we'll be back on Monday with an episode that will be less disjointed than this, swear to God. And one of these days, we'll do some more Indiana Jones stuff, including some talk about